It's the NPR News Update for Monday, June 2nd. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up on the podcast, there are newly endorsed candidates for statewide political office. We'll hear about them. The number of blacks in the Hughes grad school is shrinking. And we'll hear about Kevin Love's trip to Boston, where he talked about the basketball tradition of the Celtics. First, heavy rain over the weekend in the western suburbs of the Twin Cities, threatening homes along the Minnehaha Creek. Telly Mamayak is the spokeswoman for the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District.
Right now, creek levels are starting to go down, which is a good thing. And so lake levels are going down, and the cubic feet per second volume of water that's moving through the creek at the Hiawatha Avenue gauge is also going down. All good signs that we're heading in the right direction.
High water is threatening homes in Edina and St. Louis Park, where fire crews were putting out sandbags over the weekend to try and protect some of the homes. The high water has also caused some damage in Eden Prairie and has closed some park areas in Minneapolis. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is advising people against swimming and water skiing in Lake Minnetonka and two nearby lakes. That after the city of Mound released untreated sewage into the area's stormwater sewer system. The MPCA gave permission to the city to release the sewage in order to keep the wastewater from backing up into the basements of hundreds of homes. Mound began releasing the wastewater at six sites near Lake Minnetonka, Dutch Lake, and Lake Langdon. Mound City Manager Candace Hansen.
Heavy rainfall has caused a great deal of just groundwater infiltration into the sewer system. We share a system with Metropolitan Environmental Services. Their system is at capacity, and ours feeds into their system, and ours is at capacity. And so we were at risk of the backup that can cause from that kind of a situation.
The MPCA says wastewater likely will make its way into surrounding lakes. The agency says the sewage will increase the amount of E. coli bacteria in the lakes. The city of Minneapolis will have its health inspectors working overtime this summer to make sure the food served at festivals is safe. Curtis Gilbert reports.
Minneapolis licenses nearly 1,000 food vendors for community events each year. The state only requires the city to inspect 10% of those businesses, but now its goal will be to inspect all of them. The move comes in response to a salmonella outbreak last year at an Ecuadorian festival. It was the second largest such outbreak in state history, sickening more than 100 people and sending 19 to the hospital. Because many festivals happen on the weekend, the extra inspections will mean paying overtime. That, coupled with increased demands associated with this summer's All-Star Game and a proliferation of new restaurants, could cost up to $90,000 this year. Next year, the department wants to hire four additional full-time inspectors. The 25% staffing increase would cost more than $400,000. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The chief executive of recreational vehicle maker Arctic Cat is out following a loss reported for its fourth quarter. Tim Nelson has more.
Arctic Cat says Claude Jordan has resigned his post as the CEO of the company based in Plymouth. Chris Toomey, the former CEO who led Arctic Cat for 24 years, is returning as the interim CEO. The company's CFO has also postponed his planned retirement. Jordan had led the company for the last 3 years. The company missed its third quarter earnings and sales targets in January and reported lower than expected ATV sales growth at the time. Although the company said it expected a good 2015, the stock value tumbled by more than a quarter over a one-month stretch this spring. The company said previously it had been hurt by Canadian currency weakness. In a statement, Toomey said the company remains in strong financial shape and that its board has begun a search for a permanent CEO. Arctic Cat has about 1,500 employees and manufacturing operations in Thief River Falls and St. Cloud. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Republican-endorsed candidates for U.S. Senate, governor, and other offices are traveling the state today and tomorrow to kick off the next phase of their campaigns. Over the weekend, Republicans and Democrats endorsed candidates at their state conventions. We have two reports now, starting in Rochester with the Republicans. As Tom Scheck reports, they clarified the race for Senate, but the outlook for the campaign for governor is still unclear.
The look and feel of the Republican state convention was dramatically different from the last two elections. In those years, delegates focused on the political purity of the candidates, even if those candidates didn't have the best shot at winning the election. This time, after losing every election for statewide office since 2006, Republicans said they were looking for candidates who can win.
I am so honored to be your endorsed candidate for the United States Senate. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I humbly accept.
There's no greater example of the shift in focus than in the U.S. Senate campaign. Delegates endorsed businessman Mike McFadden over several other more conservative candidates. They backed him, even though McFadden told delegates he would stay in the race if they endorsed someone else. It's the first time in recent memory that a candidate won the endorsement without promising to abide by it. And even though McFadden may be an unknown quantity to many delegates and most Minnesotans, he has been able to raise millions of dollars in his quest to challenge DFL Senator Al Franken. McFadden now has 6 months to introduce himself to voters.
When we got into this race almost 12 months ago, I said my goal was to beat Al Franken. And that's what we focused on every day for the last 12 months, and that's what we're going to focus on every day through November.
In the race for governor, Republican delegates opted to endorse Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson over three other candidates. Johnson wasn't the most conservative candidate seeking the endorsement. In fact, he told delegates that he'd work to build support for Republicans among independents and Democrats.
It's not about picking the candidate who's been in government the longest, or the candidate who can throw out the most red meat, or the candidate whose turn it is. Winning for us as Republicans in the state of Minnesota is about picking a candidate who can bring in new voters in every region of the state and who can present a very clear, contrasting vision from that of Mark Dayton's.
Former Republican Party Chair Ron Ebensteiner says there's a new mood among delegates who are typically the most committed and active members of the party.
I get a sense from the delegates here, and just in talking, because I still keep in touch, you know, with a lot of folks, that there's less of a, a purity component, and it's more, let's get somebody who can win, who can attract enough voters in the general election to win.
But the debate over electability is far from settled in the race for governor. Jeff Johnson is facing a primary challenge from Orono businessman Scott Honor, State Representative Kurt Zellers, and former State Representative Marty Seifert. Seifert made a play for the endorsement, but left the convention after it became clear Johnson was going to win. He said he's running in the primary because he has strong support among Republicans outside the convention hall.
I'm the only candidate that has 87 counties of identified supporters supporting me. Nobody else has that. I have the best name ID. We've got resources. We've got, I think, a fantastic team that can win this thing. We've got 72 days from Sunday to win the primary, so you know, this is not just about who can beat Dayton. Now there's a second question before the delegates.
Seifert's move angered many delegates. They became even more upset after he told his supporters to leave the convention before Johnson was endorsed. Zellers and Honor both decided to stay out of the endorsement contest entirely. Zellers said a primary contest will allow a broader number of Republicans to decide the party's nominee.
By going through the primary, it makes you a better candidate when you're out there talking with not just Republicans, but independents and some Democrats that want to see the mines open, they want to see jobs come back to Minnesota, to make sure and go and reach out to them as well as the folks that are here today.
Republican leaders have repeatedly emphasized that they'll back their endorsed candidates, but contested primaries are rare in the party and the outlook is unclear. Johnson told reporters that he's ready for the challenge.
The endorsement means a lot. It has always meant a lot. There are so few examples of statewide races where somebody successfully challenged the endorsed candidate on the Republican side. In fact, I can only think of two in the last 30 or 40 years. And I don't think the party changed overnight. So there is a huge advantage to this endorsement.
The primary is on August 12th. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
And I'm Mark Zedeklik in Duluth, where Democrats endorsed Governor Mark Dayton and Senator Al Franken for re-election. With no serious primary challenge to worry about in either race, Democrats are focused on November and ways to get their supporters energized and engaged. Speaker after speaker at the DFL convention warned of dire consequences if Democrats stay home in November because presidential politics are not in play.
If you look at our blue line, a greenish line.
Congressman Keith Ellison even brought charts to make the case that Minnesota Democrats often have problems in midterm elections.
This is a midterm election year, and our folks, some of them, Well, you know what I mean. They don't always show up during that midterm election year. Drop-off voters are our challenge this year.
After winning by just 312 votes in the recount following the 2008 election, Franken told delegates his re-election hinges on DFL turnout.
It's not my hard work that's going to decide this election. It is yours.
Franken and other Democratic leaders say they believe their message that the DFL is on the side of the middle class is an easy sell. It's closing the deal that they're worried about.
Aren't you proud to be a DFLer? Yes.
Mark Dayton's 2010 margin of victory was wider than Franken's 08 nail-biter, but still close enough to draw the threat of a recount. Republicans took over both chambers of the legislature the same year, and former 8th District DFL Congressman Jim Oberstar was defeated for the first time in 3.5 decades. DFL Party Chairman Ken Martin has been talking about the risk of low DFL turnout for months.
If we don't get out and vote, that's just as good as voting Republican.
On the convention floor, Delegate Bob Boyd of Burnsville predicted DFL officials will be surprised come November how engaged the rank and file remains.
I personally will be door knocking, making phone calls, and talking to my neighbors.
Boyd said Democrats are keenly aware of DFL accomplishments and will work hard to keep the DFL in power.
I do get a sense that people are pumped up everywhere in my delegation when I talk to other folks. I see the energy and the commitment.
Democrats hope their message of a healthy state budget, a higher minimum wage, more spending for schools, and an improved state and national economy will be a winner. Republicans will argue that DFL control has brought higher taxes, more government spending, and an economy growing more slowly than it would have had they been in charge. Unlike the Republicans, the Democrats are united behind their candidates for the two biggest statewide offices going into November. The next 5 months will show whether that's enough.
Mark Zedeklik there on the NPR News Update. The number of African Americans attending graduate school at the University of Minnesota is on the decline, and administrators at the U are concerned. Since 2010, the number of blacks in the U of M's graduate and professional programs has dropped more than 15%. University leaders say they're intensifying recruitment and they're working harder to give black students the support they need to earn their degrees. Alex Friedrich has talked to campus leaders and students about the problem and what they think is causing it, and he spoke to Tom Cran on Friday.
So how is the U doing compared to other universities in this area?
African Americans now make up about 2.7% of all master's and PhD students at the U. Now, that's quite a bit behind the national average, which is about just over 10%. Now, Big Ten schools tend to be less diverse than the national average, but the U is second to last in that group as well. I think only the University of Nebraska had a lower percentage. I think Michigan State had the highest at about 4.5%.
And why is the U seeing this slip?
Well, campus leaders I talked to say they're not exactly sure why. There seems to be a problem in two main areas: increasing recruitment numbers and keeping students in the program once they arrive. Now, on recruitment, campus leaders told me they need to offer more financial support if they want to compete with other universities. And that's especially important because many African Americans come from low-income families. And the pool of college-ready black students is relatively small because black students often don't do as well as their peers in elementary, middle, and high school. Now, what isn't helping is that the U's undergraduate black numbers are also slipping. And those who do join the U's graduate program aren't finishing their graduate degrees at the rate of their peers, so they may be dropping out in greater numbers.
Now, you've been talking to students. What are they saying about this?
Well, they weren't surprised by the numbers. Now, they did give their departments high marks for recruitment and support. But they say the state, and by extension, the U itself, you know, it has a reputation of being cold, largely white, you know, with wide educational and financial disparities between, you know, white and black populations. Now, they said Minneapolis may be more than 18% African-American, but much of that community doesn't live near campus. And they said that you really needs to work hard to increase the number of black professors, which is just over 2% of faculty. It's one of the key things African-American grad students look for, you know, when they consider a graduate program.
So what is the U doing to work on this problem?
One of the regents, grad student Abdul Omari, says the fact that the U openly admits it's struggling is a huge step. And he's right. I mean, the U has been really upfront about this. On recruitment, it's trying to expand its summer research programs, so minority undergrads can get a taste of life as a grad student at the U. It's going to be targeting and recruiting grad students more intensively, and it's expanded a key diversity scholarship a little bit. Now, as a long-term step, it's working on ways to help increase the number of African-American youths overall who go to college. And to help retain those students, I think for the first time in almost a decade, it's going to have a full-time staffer to support minority students in various aspects of academic life.
So does the U have a quantifiable goal here that they're working on? And how large a black graduate student body are they looking for?
Well, I pressed officials on this one, but they shied away repeatedly from setting concrete numbers. They did say they want to make incremental improvement each year that meets or exceeds the national average.
Alex Friedrich, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Alex and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. The best player on the Minnesota Timberwolves was in Boston over the weekend. He was there touting the storied history, not of the Wolves, but of the Boston Celtics. That visit has fueled speculation that Love's days with the Wolves are numbered. Morning Edition's Kathy Werzer talked about it with Star Tribune digital sports editor Howard Sinker.
You know, whenever I went to Boston, it really never caused that much of a stir, Kathy.
Oh, I'm sure that's right, Howard. You know, people are really talking about this. What's the deal?
Well, it's kind of a fun and funny story. Of course, if you're a Timberwolves fan, it's somewhat maddening to see the best player on your team, a player whose future is definitely in doubt locally, basically spend the weekend in Boston. Court fans make no secret of the fact he's there, and talk about the wonderful, great tradition of the Boston Celtics franchise.
Well,
and, of course, he went on this vacation, as your Bob Collins pointed out, with his agent. So that really doesn't happen every day. I think there's a not-so-hidden agenda here that Kevin Love, even though he didn't come out and say it, really would rather not be in Minnesota. And on the whole, he'd rather be in Boston.
Would this put more pressure, then, on the Timberwolves to trade Kevin Love?
Well, it would. And one of the things that Boston has is a whole bunch of first-round draft picks over the next few years. They could create a pretty good package that would help the Wolves in the future. For example, Boston has the 6th and the 17th picks in this year's draft. They have 2 first-round picks next year. And I think they have 9 first-round picks over the next 5 years, including their own and others that they've gotten in trade. So there's a package that could be put together there. And I'm really not going to be surprised if Love has gone before the draft.
But he really has no control over where he's traded, right?
Oh, he has no control over where he's traded, but the NBA is a league where players aren't shy about making their preferences known, whether or not they have that much leverage. And if the Wolves don't trade him after next year, Love can pretty much go wherever he wants. So this actually may be a good thing for the Timberwolves, because he's being so blatant about the fact that he doesn't want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say what Kevin Love is thinking, but I'm just putting it all together from what we're seeing and reading and he's talking about.
So it would appear he doesn't want to be here, but does it make any sense at all for the Wolves to keep him and maybe try to re-sign him?
I can't see a scenario, barring other dramatic and sudden moves that I can't anticipate or think of, that would create a situation where he'd want to stay. Everything the Timberwolves have done since Kevin Love has been here is pretty much blown up. And if you're him, do you want a fresh start somewhere where you would perceive that the team has more of a clue and a winning record?
Okay. Well, obviously, stay tuned.
Absolutely. This is a great off-season story. It's just going to be great fun to watch, as long as you don't take it too personally.
Howard Sinker and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition and the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi, glad to be in your ears, waxing about the news. We'll do it again here tomorrow.